Friday Night Wine Fight contains coarse language and adult themes. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome to Friday Night Wine Fight.
I'm Bianca.
I'm Sarah.
And I'm Amy. We are three Melbourne girls who had nothing better to do than start a podcast while we were all living la vida locked down. But now we're free. Yay. So we take aim at one topic each week with a bottle or three of wine and we try to make some sense of it. Right, ladies, what are we drinking?
Well, I am drinking, as suggested by the lovely friendly staff at Dare Murphy's, the Vegan Wine Project Pinot Grigio. Oh, and she told me actually a fun fact, all the winemakers are all women.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm just going to crack it. I'm just going to pour myself a glass. I have no idea, never tried this before. So yeah. Yeah, this is going to be a fun evening. All right, Sarah, what have you got?
Well, I thought, actually I've had this wine sitting here for a bit and I've been waiting for a topic like this so I can crack it open. So I'm drinking the Kylie Minogue, and I'm going to do this to piss Amy off just because she has written a little note next to this. Rose. I'm drinking
Rose.
Kylie Minogue Rose.
Rose.
Isn't yeah. it lovely to hear Amy correct me?
I just heard a head explode. So
yeah. And one of these days it really is, and it's probably going to be because of me.
Oh, it did. Oh, I have a cloth here. I'm just wiping off my screen and my microphone because my head's exploding.
But it's delicious. Slightly singed. Delicious.
Oh, I'm drinking the R. Palazzo Rosé, which is now mixed with pieces of my brain matter. Thanks, Sarah.
You shouldn't have put it there.
I was going to
say it properly. And then you put that little, it's pronounced rosé, next to it. I'm like, nah, fuck you.
I was trying to help, mate. I was just trying to help.
Yes, we've known each other for you to actually know. You shouldn't try to help because I'm going to do it to piss you off.
I'm just trying to help you, man.
Get my kicks. This is how I get my kicks, people. Pissing Amy off.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So we roll.
Don't become friends with someone for over 20 years because it becomes vicious and vindictive.
And I'm usually the antagonist, which is why she gets her kicks out of little things like this. So, it's well-deserved. I'm just putting it out there. All right, Bianca, what is our topic for tonight?
Crikey! Our topic tonight is murder down under. Now, you've got to be real careful, mate. It's not just the creatures that'll kill you in Australia. It's the people too. Sorry about that. I regret nothing.
I had to.
If you would like Bianca to do more Crocodile Hunter impressions, email us at FridayNightWineFight@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram or Tumblr.
And that is also going to be our trailer. Just letting you know.
Yes. So, but seriously, Australia is a tough country for those that don't know. We've got the heat, the flies, the bushfires, then the cold, and the animals, and the flies, and the floods in summer. And then there's people. Like, it's just.
Oh, don't forget the flies. There's flies.
There's flies. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's actually life. Just a one-day event.
Yeah.
Just letting you know.
In Melbourne.
That's just Melbourne.
That's just Melbourne.
So, yeah, look, Australia was thrust into the modern world as a place to send convicted felons. Whether you killed a guy or blasphemed, you got a one-way ticket to a country where the trip over didn't kill you. Maybe a drop bear will. Or a drop beer. Yeah, go watch out for them drop beers, eh? So, yeah, look, as far as murderers or serial killers go, we have had our fair share. And there are a few names that will forever rattle around in the minds of Australians, like infamous bushman Ned Kelly. Now, please note, this is as much as any of us are willing to talk about him because, quite frankly, he gets too much airtime and doesn't deserve the hero icon because he is a thief and a murderer. Moving on. Yep, moving on. So next we have Ivan Milat. He murdered 7 backpackers in the early 90s. I'm not going into any of these because we may cover them. So I'm just sort of just cliff notes, people. So another one that's quite prevalent is Frank Vitkovic. I said that completely wrong. Sorry, Frank. He went
Don't apologize to him. He's a public nuisance in the court system. But anyway, yep.
I know. The other thing is, too, he did go on the brutal massacre on Queen Street in Melbourne in December of 1987, which left 8 people dead and injured another 5 in an attack that lasted 17 minutes.
I think that was Huddle Street.
That's Queen Street.
I'm thinking of a different person.
You're thinking of the gangsters, which I didn't write down.
No. There was a dude that got out of his car and started picking people off on Hoddle Street, and he killed like 17 people or something. A lot of people in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. I can't remember his name. Damn it. Lastly, one that is especially prevalent, and not just because of what he did, but because of the events that followed. So this is Martin Bryant. Not only did, hey, Gilly, 28-year-old Martin Bryant go down as one of the most cold-blooded killers in local history when he gunned down 35 men, women, and children in Tasmania in April of 1996, but Australia became the undisputed global leader on gun control. Yay!
Yes.
Yep.
You did.
You're a C-word, sir, but... Also, thank you.
Excuse me, sir. You're a C-word.
I don't C-word. Want to say I'll, it on it.
I'll see myself out, thank you. Sorry, rest of development.
I'll leave when I'm ready.
Yeah. Every time I hear the C-word, that's all pops into my mind.
Sorry, I just didn't want to say it. You know, not very many people like that word.
Yeah.
We love that word.
So we love that word, but maybe our listeners don't.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, hit us up at FridayNightWineFight@gmail.com and let us know, do you like the C word? So, yeah, the Port Arthur massacre was 3 years before Columbine and long before the ongoing threat of American mass shootings. Australia could very well have had a similarly, I can never say that word right, long list of massacre tragedies had the John Howard government not taken action with gun control that same year. Howard's new laws removed semi-automatic and pump-action shotguns and rifles from civilian possession. And the statistics now show that over the last 25 years, gun-related incidences are down 22%, which is massive on a world scale.
I am not saying a single word about this because I will get on a soapbox and I will not come down. So.
Yeah, I tried to cover as much as I could so that Amy wouldn't go on a soapbox. So with all that out of the way, I'm going to crack on to my murderer, which is Francesco Mangione, or otherwise known as the Ice Cream Turf War. So, Francesco Mangione, born 23rd of July 1957 in Sicily. In 1969, he came to Australia and he lived in Moonee Ponds in Victoria. He was apprenticed to the former State Electricity Commission of Victoria and in 1978 named by the Industrial Training Commission of Victoria as the Outstanding Radio Tradesman Apprentice of that year. He departed the SECV in 1989 and began operating an ice cream van. In 1992, Mangione was arrested and detained for 3 nights over the Easter weekend. They detained him based on the following charges: child stealing, committing an indecent act with a child under the age of 16, and unlawful assault. He was later released due to there being no evidence to support charges over a missing six-year-old girl found in his ice cream van.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Mangione said he was pleased that the Director of Public Prosecutions had dropped the charges. The right thing has been done. I said at the time I'd done nothing wrong. I've now been proved right. I'm happy it is all finished. Mr. Mangione said that the girl had been helping him in the van, but only after she had received permission from her mother. How about fuck off? She was 6 years old.
Hey, he could have been 100% right because, like, I mean, in that time, people trusted people. Whereas, like, you know, nowadays, if an ice cream van worker says, hey, do you mind if I take your six-year-old for a ride in my van? You'd be like, no, and I'm calling the police.
Yeah.
Well, so when I was researching Mangione for the case, which I'm going to get to next, every news article that I could find had, when it was talking about the case, it had just a line that, previously in 92, he was detained for, a six-year-old girl being found in his van. And I'm like, but why? But why? So I had to actually find, this is as much information as there is out there. I literally, like, I couldn't find any more than that. I don't know why, aside from his testimony that he said the mother gave permission. I don't know. I mean, at the time too, his children were 10, 6, and 3. So he had young children himself. Well, why would he take a six-year-old girl when he's got three at home?
And I'm just looking at the list of charges here, and I'm just sort of working it through based on what I know from the criminal justice system. So child stealing, that's out because he probably did ask the mother if it was okay. She probably said yes. Committing an indecent act with a child under the age of 16 and unlawful assault. Okay, so that's not rape. So there may have not been any physical evidence. It might have been anecdotal evidence that the six-year-old gave. And then once they questioned her a few times, she probably didn't want to say it ever again. So she almost like recanted what she said.
Yeah.
So it's possible that the DPP just went, we don't have enough here. We don't have enough.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't mean he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm still saying fuck off.
Yeah, fuck off. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll start off with the how the turf war started. So the very next year, in 1993, an incident occurred between Mangione and his family with that of his cousin, Peter Gewinter. Now, Peter Gewinter was also an ice cream van operator. The incident that occurred, it's not documented anywhere what actually happened. And I think it was probably to do with the trial and stuff like that. Like, they obviously need to keep things quiet so that they could use it in court, you know, like things were held from the media. So I couldn't actually find what escalated into this decade-long turf war. So on the 5th of February 2002, 26-year-old Dennis Gewinter, who is the son of Peter Gewinter, returned home from work, jumped into the shower, and while he was in there, Francesco broke into his young cousin's house. He was wearing a ski mask and gloves to hide his identity. After showering, Dennis stepped naked and unarmed into his bedroom where his wife Laura lay sleeping and Mangione was waiting. Mangione then attacked Dennis, slashing, stabbing, and hacking him 55 times with a homemade iron sword.
Jesus.
I can't even. Laura, awakened by her husband's screams, escaped via the bedroom's balcony. So they lived in one of those, you know, like the city townhouses that has one.
Yeah.
And so she got out the balcony. She jumped onto the garage, jumped down to the ground, and broke her leg.
Blech.
Yep.
Nope.
Dennis died at the scene from his massive injuries.
Oh.
Mangione fled the scene, dropping the weapon And this is how he was connected to the murder. So his DNA was found on the handle of the sword, and tools were found in his home which were forensically linked to the making of the weapon, and DNA samples from the bloodstained glove left at the scene. So the idiot left his glove behind, and they matched the DNA taken from Mangione. So they just took his DNA, they took the DNA from the glove, DNA from the sword, and they found all the tools. So on the 13th of February 2004, Mangione was found guilty by a jury. He was sentenced to 22 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 18 years. On 21st of February 2006, the Supreme Court of Victoria Court of Appeal dismissed Mangione's appeal against the severity of his sentence. Mangione continues to maintain his innocence to this day.
How?
Yeah, it's like he says it's not him. But I'm sorry, the DNA on the glove, like, there is no way that it couldn't be him. And so, in the drive, so I'll put it on the blog for our listeners. You can see the first picture is the sword.
Yeah, that's a gnarly looking sword.
Yeah.
Like bent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, like one of those like slashy things that you would like take to a crop with.
Yeah, a sickle. And then I've got pictures of Laura with her broken leg.
Can't even with that. Blech.
She's got rods and shit. Like, it was a
fair. I know. I'm seeing it in my head as she jumps down. I can hear the breaking of the bones. It's making me feel sick.
The bone that would have stuck out.
So there's a picture of Mangione, and then this is one of the last pictures of Dennis Gwinter.
Oh, my God. He looks like the guy from work. I'm not even kidding.
It's not him, mate.
It's obviously not him, but he looks like him.
I just can't get over looking at these pictures. We already had a hint of their age difference, but I mean, this dude is like, he's quite a bit older. Like, what could they have been fighting about?
Yeah.
Like, I know it was a turf war over an ice cream van.
Well, it wasn't even a turf war with Dennis. It was a turf war with Dennis's father, Peter. And, oh, God, Peter at the court, like, one of his quotes was, a massive light of his life is now missing. Like, there's just,
So this kid had nothing to do with it. Literally nothing.
No.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as else I could find was they were both, they had certain streets that they could sell on, but when it got to Essendon, it got a bit blurred. It's ice cream. Like,
not drugs,
guys,
people,
you're from,
it's ice cream.
Yeah. You're from Sicily. I mean, warning shots, people. Put a horse head in the bed or something. Like, calm your shit.
Yeah.
Calm down.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Like, I don't know how much behind the scenes actually happened, because was there a horse head? Could have been.
Well, they're Sicilian, so, they are basically, Don Corleone's crew. So, yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible. And the fact that
Journey's definitely the Frodo of the family, but anyway.
Fuck yeah. So I can't get past the fact that, like, I don't think I really knew much about this before you started talking about it. I vaguely recognize this whole ice cream turf war thing, but I recognize it from looking at, like, true crime in, like, gang-related sort of stuff or, like, mafioso sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that there's been nothing makes me think that there was obviously some other investigation going on about something that was, clearly linked to these guys.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows? We could speculate all we want, but, the fact that there's nothing else around this is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I really searched. And
tell them what you did. Tell them what you did.
I wanted to read an article and I could not find an archive of a newspaper from 1992, so I joined the State Library of Victoria.
No.
And
she
I joined
was getting
it,
in deep,
like,
people. In deep.
I was in deep. I did. I sent you guys a gif of that fox jumping into the snow, like, boom, that's me. I was like ass deep.
I was fuzzy tail deep, okay? Yeah. So deep I got into this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's mine, the ice cream turfer.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, what
Don't
have you
mess
got
with
for
Mr.
us?
Whippy.
Yeah, they were actually Mr. Whippies.
So not only were they killing people, they were playing green sleeves as they were doing it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's hardcore.
You know what? The only reason I know the words to green sleeves, I think it was because of your mum, Sarah.
There's fucking words to it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure your mum's the one that told me them.
She never freaking told me.
Right, after you've done recording, go ask her. I want to know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was her.
That it could have been Nana.
I was going to say.
Could have been Nana.
Could have been
Nana.
That
woman had way too much useless information.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, I'll crack on to mine.
Yes.
Okay, so my case that I'm going to be looking at this evening is the Claremont serial killings, and it was given the name in the media because the case involved the disappearance of an 18-year-old Australian woman and the killings of two others aged 23 and 27 in 1996 to 1997. And now all of these three women disappeared from a wealthy western suburb of Perth called Claremont. So hence the name. All three women disappeared after attending night spots in similar circumstances. So the police then started to think, well, maybe there is a unidentified serial killer in the area. Mm. So the case was described as the state's biggest, longest running and most expensive investigation they've ever had. Now, the murders went unsolved for a really, really long time. In 2016, a suspect, Bradley Robert Edwards, was arrested. He was held on remand and his trial began in November 2019 and ended on the 25th of June 2020 after 7 months of hearings and evidence from more than 200 witnesses. 200 witnesses.
Fuck.
Yeah. I mean, by the time you get someone in the box and then you do your bit and then the other side cross-examines, one witness can take, you know, an hour or two if their evidence is short and there isn't much to dispute. Whereas if you've got someone who's got contested testimony, then they could be in the box for a day or two.
Oh,
so that's
Jesus.
That's the reason. And sometimes you can be in the box for a week. Like it's insane.
Oh my God.
It's mentally draining for everybody. It's mentally
draining.
I
couldn't imagine anything being in the box for that long.
It's mentally draining for the witness. It's mentally draining for the defense. It's mentally draining for the prosecution. It's mentally draining for everybody, the jury, the judge. It's hard stuff. Anyway, so they persevered 7 months later and 200 witnesses. They came to a conclusion. On the 27th of September 2020, he was found guilty of the murders of Jane Rimmer and, now I'm going to say this wrong, I want to say Ciara. But it might, I don't know how you say that, but Ciara Glennon, and not guilty of the murder of Sarah Spears, whose remains have been yet to be located. On the 23rd of December 2020, so about a month ago, he was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 40 years. So you got 20 years per murder. So now I'll talk you through the case. The case began with the disappearance of Sarah Spears. She was 18 years old on the 27th of January, 1996. Now she left the Club Bayview in the center of Claremont around 2 a.m. At 2:06, Sarah called a taxi from a public phone booth because, well, my young friends out there, once upon a time, we didn't have mobile phones. And there used to be these boxes, you know, that used to be in areas around the streets and used to be able to put coins in them. You remember what coins are? There's those round dealies that your parents have. Yeah.
Or you did reverse charges.
Yeah.
And whoever you called, their parents fucking hated you.
Yeah.
And at 2 a.m., you're not reverse charging anybody, let alone a taxi company, because they're going to say, oh, no, thanks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, so she called a taxi from a phone box on the side of the road. However, she was sighted waiting alone near the corner of Stirling Road and the Stirling Highway by three witnesses who also mentioned seeing an unidentified car stopping where she was waiting. However, she was not at the site when the responding taxi arrived at 2:09. Literally 3 minutes.
Wow.
It took this taxi to get there and she was gone. 3 minutes. Yeah. So in the dark, it could have been that the driver just missed her. we don't know. There's no way to know. So her disappearance soon attracted massive publicity, and her fate remains unknown, because although he ended up pleading guilty to two of the murders, he ended up pleading guilty to the charges that were non-murder related. And then got found guilty of two of the murders. He never said what he did with the other one, but it's most likely he killed her. Okay, so the next one happened about 6 months later, in the early hours of the Sunday, the 9th of June, 1996. Jane Rimmer, who was 23, from Shenton Park, also disappeared in the same part of Claremont. Similar to Sarah, she had been out socialising with friends the night before. Rimmer's friends explained how they had moved from Ocean Beach Hotel to the Continental Hotel and then to Club Bayview. Noting the line was really long, her friends decided to catch a taxi home, but she decided that she was going to stay. And the last they saw her, well, the last she was seen on security footage waiting out the front of the Continental at 12:04 in the morning. 55 days later, on the 3rd of August, 1996, her naked body was found 40 kilometres, so that's 25 miles for our American listeners, south in bushland near Woolcott Road by a family picking wildflowers. This is why you don't go in the nature.
I don't know if we stress this enough for our listeners. Don't go in the nature.
That poor family.
They've never picked the flowers since. They've sworn off the nature.
I'm pretty sure their whole backyard is now being concreted. So, yeah.
Yeah.
9 months later, in the early hours of the 15th of March, 97, Sierra Glennon, a 27-year-old lawyer from Mossman Park, also disappeared from the Claremont area. Like the others, she was with friends at Continental, and then she decided to make her own way home. Three men at a bus stop saw her walking south towards the Stirling Highway at approximately 12:30 a.m. and observed her interacting with an unidentified light-coloured vehicle which had stopped nearby. 19 days later, on the 3rd of April, her semi-clothed body was found by a bushwalker 40 kilometres, again 25 miles north, near a track in scrub off the Pippindi Road in Ellington. I don't know how to say that right. Anyway, so it's a bit fucked, to be perfectly honest.
Yes.
Just real fucked. So, one of the main pieces of evidence that was in this trial was the fact that people had witnessed these girls getting into or seeing a Telstra work vehicle coming up close to them. So the man who was eventually charged and convicted with the murders, Edwards, he was working as a technician at the time, and it was claimed that he used company vehicles for after-hours activities like executing his crimes. This was corroborated by a witness who was a security guard who recalled seeing a Telkom van, so Telkom, Telstra, same thing.
Yeah.
Telkom van parked on multiple occasions near a cemetery for no apparent reason. Both after the 1995 attack on a young woman, which actually she survived that one. I'll get to those later. And before the disappearance of Spears in 1996. So according to the prosecutor, the state presented this evidence as a part of the Telstra Living Witness Project. This is a thing. So between 1995 and 1997, a man with a Telstra station wagon stopped to look at women and offer them rides. Seven women said that they were given rides by somebody in a Telstra van.
What?
Some of them got home safe, but others bailed out of the car given the opportunity because something didn't feel right. There's some evidence actually that was presented by one of these.
Getting into a van with a strange man didn't feel right? Go figure.
It was Perth. It was 96. And it was a Telstra van. You would think, well, if he murders me, they can trace him, right? I don't know. There was one particular piece of evidence that I actually thought was interesting. So one of these chicks was walking along the side of the road and her friend was real drunk and she was trying to, figure out, well, what do I do? Do I just, put her down here and then, find a phone box and call a taxi? I don't know if a taxi would take us. And then this dude came along and so she threw her friend in the back. And then she got in the front. And then after a few minutes, she started to feel very uneasy. And her friend was basically passed out. So they stopped at lights and she went, okay, I'm out. So she bailed out of the car, ran to the back of the van, grabbed her friend, dragged her out of the van, and then ran, carrying her friend, basically. I was just like, wow, you a strong bitch. My bitches probably would have left me in the back of the van.
I'd carry her.
I'd drag you. Wouldn't carry you.
Get up, bitch.
You I might think get you just murdered. Get some, you know, some of that mama bear strength, and you just suddenly, like, heave you up in the shoulders and just run. Like,
yeah.
Drag my heavy ass across the pavement. It's fine. It's fine. Another piece of evidence that I thought was really interesting that I wanted to discuss was during the trial, a witness from the group of men dubbed the Burger Boys. Yeah. So if you have a look, if you Google Burger Boys Claremont, there actually was a guy who was a young dude who left the Continental Hotel with his other mates, and they were hungry. So they went to Hungry Jack's. This was about midnight.
Oh, yeah.
And because the evidence that he presented of, we were drunk and hungry, so we left the Conti, we went round the corner to Hungry Jack's, and he happened to see the van and one of the victims, they were dubbed the Burger Boys.
That's so Australian.
I know, right? And this was the other thing that was hilarious about it. So drunk young blokes left the Conti Hotel and decided they were hungry and went for Hungry Jack's. You know how that they could make a positive identification of the vehicle? Because it was a Series 1 VS Commodore station wagon. And it had teardrop hubcaps.
Oh, and one God, of them
noticed. Yeah.
It was fully sick. Yeah.
It was full sick, mate. It was full sick.
Oh, sick. One of you'll do a burnout for us.
In fact, one of them probably stumbled across Draco. Drop a Zowie!
Rip him up!
Yeah, that's how they remember. Between 1996 and December 1998, Edwards, who was the perpetrator in this, drove a white VS series wagon with Telstra logos. So they didn't remember the Telstra logos. Oh, no, I don't. Well, I don't think so. I'd be corrected if I'm wrong. But now they just remember, oh, fully sick Commodore with the teardrop hubcaps. Oh, yeah. That's what they remembered. Yeah.
100% understandable. Who remembers Telstra vehicles?
They found the vehicle when they arrested him in 2016 and impounded on the same day. So during the hearing, it was revealed that fibres matching the carpet in the rear of the vehicle match fibres found on the bodies of both Rimmer and Glennon, although the defence argued that these fibres could have come from anywhere and was not necessarily something that was in the WA crime database. So inconclusive at best is what they argued. Yeah. So on the 22nd of December 2016, Bradley Robert Edwards, born in 1968, was arrested in his Kewdale house in relation to the deaths of both Rimmer and Glennon. The next day, he was charged with both of the murders. According to ABC News, he was believed to have no previous link to the case, although he pleaded guilty to the aggravated assault of a social worker at Hollywood Hospital the 7th of May 1990. This is where his undoing comes. He was also charged in relation to two other attacks prior to the murders. So one was the house break in and enter and unlawful detention of an 18-year-old woman in Huntingdale on the 15th of February, 88. He dropped a kimono, a dressing gown with his DNA at the scene as he left. So they picked that up in 88. They didn't have a lot of good DNA technology, but they kept it just in case. And that's what the practice of the time was. If you did come across DNA, they were hoping for scientific progression. And they just held on to everything. And then he was also charged with the unlawful detention and two counts of aggravated sexual penetration without consent of a 17-year-old girl in Claremont on the 12th of February, 1995. So they managed through those previous attacks and the evidence found there to link him back after they had some scientific advancements in the areas of DNA.
That's one thing I must say about Australia and the way that we, our legal professionals, our medical professionals, and our police force and all the rest of it, their thought process is things are going to progress. We must keep things because technology is always progressing. Whereas America's like, oh, just throw it in a box somewhere and fucking forget about it. Oh, no, just throw it in the trash. Who cares?
No, yeah, just burn it. It's fine.
Yeah, that's one thing I must say. But, yeah, Australia, we are always thinking of the advancements and something better will come along and, hey, we might catch that person.
You never know.
Yeah.
So on the 22nd of February 2018, Edwards was also charged with the willful murder of the third victim, Spears. In all, Edwards was charged with 8 offences. And on the 21st of October 2019, Edwards pleaded guilty to the 5 non-murder charges. So the reason why there was a trial is because he did not plead guilty to the murder charges. So the murder trial concluded on the 25th of June 2020 after 7 months of hearings and evidence from more than 200 witnesses. The judge who presided over the matter, he had then retired and he retired to consider his verdict, flagging that it may be handed down before the, I'm trying to remember how you say this. So it might be handed down before the remand in custody ends. So if you're remanded in custody, it's for a certain period of time. So effectively, if the judge has retired to consider his verdict, there may be some issues with like timelines and things like that. So if there is a lot of evidence like there was in this case, the judge would have been pressured to make sure that he has a verdict before this guy gets out because he could fuck off.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. Anyway, so on the final day of custody, the justice handed down a 619-page written verdict within which Edwards was found guilty of the murders of Rimmer and Glennon, but not of Spears, although it was more likely that Edwards was involved in her disappearance than not. That was in the judgment. So on the 23rd of December 2020, Edwards was sentenced to life imprisonment with a non-parole period of 40 years. The justice said that there was a high likelihood that he would die in prison. He's now 51, so, yeah, probs will. That will make him 90-something.
Oh. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. But if there's a fun little thing about this is that it's been suggested by a journalist that Spears was not the first victim. He wrote that police had told the father of a fourth missing victim, 22-year-old Julie Cutler, that his daughter was probably the victim of the Claremont killer. Cutler, a university student from Fremantle, vanished after leaving a staff function at the Hilton Hotel in Perth at 9 o'clock on the 20th of June 1988. Her car was found near the surf at Cottesloe Beach 2 days later, and her fate remains unknown. So she may have been the first victim. There's other possible victims too. So that includes Lisa Brown, who was 19. She was a sex worker who disappeared on the 10th of November 1998. And Sarah McMahon, who was 20, and she disappeared on the 8th of November 2000.
Oh, my gosh.
They just don't have enough. They just don't have enough to tie him to these ones, but it's possible. So they don't know. Ugh. But, yeah, I thought I'd cover this one just because the verdict came down fairly recently, and it's one that I have been monitoring because I'm a bit of a true crime fanatic, and I have listened to so many coverings of this particular case, and I've listened to them from the point where they didn't even know who a suspect was or anything like that. There is so much deep dive into who the suspects could have been, but now in hindsight with the DNA evidence and everything else, it's I feel like it's pretty open and shut. And yeah, it's just interesting to see how that all pieced together after so many years. So yeah, that's me done.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's
you unpacked a lot there. Yeah. I actually stopped drinking my wine. I was so intently listening. Oh, my God.
Wow, mine's nowhere near that interesting. Oh, fuck.
Yes, it is. I have listened to your case, a couple of coverings of your case, Sarah, and, wow, I'm eager to hear your take on it. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, mine doesn't really cover much of it. I do a lot of backstory, okay, because I find her backstory really interesting. So I'm doing Catherine Mary Knight. So she was born in 1955 in Aberdeen in New South Wales, Hunter Valley. Yeah, when I first heard about her, I'm like, this woman is fucking crazy. It's kind of fascinating. So she was born into a dysfunctional family. Her father was an alcoholic who raped her mother up to 10 times a day.
Oh,
I mean, that's insane. That guy. He never touched the children. It was okay. Just the mother. But it was reported that Catherine was actually sexually assaulted by members of the family until she was 11.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so oh, it's not when she was older, it was when she was little. So that could have had a huge effect. It had a huge effect. Let's just face it.
Provided it's true. Like, I don't want to shit on people, but like a lot of the time, that's a defense.
The family members came out and said, yeah, that's true.
Look, if it's true, I feel sorry for what happened to her. I don't feel sorry for her, but I feel sorry for what happened to her. And yeah, don't touch kids. It can fuck them up.
Yeah.
So she wasn't really close to any members of her family. Surprise, surprise. Except for her twin sister and her uncle. But sadly, the uncle committed suicide in 1969. And she believed that his ghost visited her and still does.
Yeah, fair enough.
Did you? Why not?
Yeah. I have several in my house, so yeah.
I still think someone's living in your roof.
It's me.
It's Amy.
It's me. Shut up.
Sorry. She left school at 15 without learning how to read or write. And sort of, yeah.
15?
At 15.
And she didn't know how to read or write.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Australian education system at its best.
Oh.
Still better than America's. she got a job as a cutter at a clothing factory, but that only lasted a year. And after that, she started what she called her dream job as a cutter of offal at the local abattoir, where she was quickly promoted to boning.
Oh, no.
And I'm going to giggle at the term boning. But
where her dad worked too? Didn't her dad also work there?
Well, I didn't find any information about where her father worked.
Okay, because I've got a feeling that this is the one where that was, yeah, it was almost like she was like following him in his footsteps, because I think he used to work there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't find anything about him. But they gave her her own set of butcher's knives, which she hung over her bed, a habit she actually kept until she was arrested.
Yeah, that's weird as shit. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I'm missing above my bed. I've got my posters, my CDs. I'm missing my set of butcher's knives. I really feel like that would just bring out the light in the room.
I don't know about you, but like if I walked into someone's bedroom, whether it be a casual hookup or just a mate, and I saw butcher's knives hanging over their bed, I'd be like, okay, I'm out. Bye.
Yeah. 100%.
You're clearly psychotic. Yeah.
Yeah. Clearly. Moving on to her first marriage. So her first marriage was, I can't even say the last name because I feel like I will say it wrong, to David Klett.
Colette. Meh.
They met at work in 1973, and they married just a year later. Way too soon.
Way too soon.
Yeah. On their wedding night. So David had already had words with the mother, and she was like, don't fuck with the kid. Don't fuck with her. She will fuck you up. On the wedding night, Catherine actually tried to strangle her new husband because he fell asleep after having sex for the third time that night because she wasn't fully satisfied. People, make sure your woman is fully satisfied.
Amen.
Don't marry a crazy bitch, because after three times and you haven't managed to bust one out yourself, something is wrong.
Something is very wrong. Things didn't get much better from there. One night when she was heavily pregnant, she burnt all of David's clothes and shoes before picking up a frying pan and hitting him in the back of the head.
Look, pregnant bitches be crazy.
Yeah, he came home late.
Yeah. And pregnant crazy bitches be even crazier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was able to talk herself out of having charges pressed.
Because it was 1973 and she was a woman. There was no such thing as domestic violence. And there was definitely no such thing as domestic violence committed by a woman.
Oh, no.
It's still bad now.
David. She talked David out of pressing charges.
Yeah, but, like, what was he going to do? Go to the cop station, go, my wife hit me in 1973. Like, that was ever going to happen. It doesn't happen now. Men won't go to the police. Yeah. And bitches are crazy.
Bitches are crazy. So shortly after the birth of their child in May of 1976, David left Catherine for another woman and moved to Queensland to get away from the abuse.
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough.
Just a day later, she was seen pushing her new baby down the street, throwing the pram from side to side quite violently. You know how you rock your pram, you know, just having fun with the baby? Usually you do it when they're a toddler.
Yeah.
They love it.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like what she was doing, though.
That was not what she was doing. She was throwing it from side to side. She was actually admitted to the St. Elmo's Hospital in Tamworth, where she was diagnosed with postnatal depression.
And she set fire to things? Can't help it.
And she...
St. Elmo's.
I know, that's why I put it in there. I'm like, St. Elmo's. Yeah, she spent around 2 months recovering. But after that, when she was released, she took her two-month-old baby and placed her on the train track. Like a cartoon villain, just placed her on the train track. Not long before the train was due to arrive.
I'm renaming her Dustily Dick.
Then
she is a dick.
Yeah.
She is
a dick.
Then she stole an axe and threatened to kill several people in the town.
So the baby was okay in the end, wasn't it? Or did it get run over by a train?
Well, a man known as Old Ted.
Oh, yep. Good old Ted. Yep.
Good old Ted.
Super Ted. Yep.
Anyway, don't distract me, Bianca. Old Ted was actually foraging around the railway when he found the baby and rescued her just minutes. Like, this was like a minute before the train came.
Bless you, Old Ted. Oh, yes. Still alive. Old Ted.
Yeah.
Legend. So, again, she was arrested, taken to St. Elmo's. But she checked herself out the very next day. I'm all good. So good. I'm all right. I'm just going to sort myself out and go home, okay? Yeah, excellent. Thanks. So a couple of days after this happens, Catherine takes out one of her knives and attacks a woman by slashing her across the face.
Oh, my God.
Then demands her to drive to Queensland to find poor David.
Oh my God.
We're not done with David, so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So now this poor woman who had been slashed across the face was able to escape when they stopped at a service station for our American listeners.
We call them servos.
We call them servos.
Servo, bottle-o. Yeah. Yeah. Just a lot of O's. Yeah.
A lot of O's. By the time the cops got to Catherine, Catherine had taken a young boy hostage by knife point. Now, the police were able to disarm her with brooms. Yes? Brooms.
Oh, my fucking God.
Amazing.
I mean, there are police. There's, like, parts of the police force in certain countries in some places. I was going to say it, but I'm not going to say it. America. Who keep saying that they need AK-47s in order to take down criminals. How about getting schooled by some police in New South Wales in the 70s? They took her down with brooms.
Fucking brooms.
You do not need your AK-47s.
They sweeped that trash right into their dippy van. That's what happened.
That's how you take out the trash, y'all. Okay.
Now, she was then admitted to the Morissette Psychiatric Hospital, where she then confessed that she was actually planning on killing the mechanic at the service station because he was the one that fixed David's car so he could leave.
Oh, my God.
Then she was going to go to Queensland and kill David and his mother.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. Now the crazy shit here is that when the police informed David of this, he left his girlfriend, moved him and his mother back to Aberdeen to support Catherine.
Oh, my fucking God.
Why? Why, sir? Why?
It's because it's victim guilt. So basically what happens is that you see the crazy shit that goes on behind you after you leave. And as much as you may have a really good reason to leave, you just go, holy fuck, there's literally a fucking bomb that went off after I left. If I go back, maybe they'll calm the fuck down and nobody else will get hurt. Whereas this is just getting out of control. She's just getting worse and worse and worse. I could sit here and just do my own thing and, you know, ignore what she's doing. But if I go back, maybe other people won't get hurt. And that's it's a victim mentality thing. So,
take a kid and run away and hide.
Not when I say victim mentality, I don't mean like as in he's thinking he's the victim. No. It's the mentality of an actual victim who thinks that maybe they could help other people by returning to their abuser.
Well, he's a dickhead. So, she was released in August 1976 and put into the care of her mother-in-law and husband. And then they moved to Ipswich, which is Brisbane, Queensland.
Yeah.
Where she got a job at the Dynmore Meatworks nearby. In 1980, they had another daughter. And in 84, she left David and moved to her parents' house in Aberdeen. Then rented a house nearby in Muswell Brook. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Which is just outside of Aberdeen, and she got her job back at the abattoir, only to injure her back a year later and go on disability pension. Then moved into a commission house in Aberdeen. Just putting it down there, she had both her daughters.
How the fuck do you let her fucking move back to Aberdeen with the two girls?
Yep, I know. So in 1986, she meets her new partner, David Saunders. I know. She has a thing with David. A 38-year-old minor. I know. David's marks. Fuck, it starts with one and it all goes downhill.
Yeah.
Look, she's just on trend. Like, she's just trying to only learn one name so that when she cries out a name, it's the same name. Yeah. So I get it. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. So he's a 38-year-old minor who, after a couple of months, would move in with her and her daughters. Yes, both the daughters. But he still kept his apartment. Smart move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It wasn't long before Catherine became jealous of things that he would be doing when she was not around. Like going out for lunch, I suppose. I don't know. It never specified what he was doing. She would actually kick him out and he would go back to his apartment. And then she would follow him and beg him to come back.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. So then in 1987, she cut the throat of his two-month-year-old dingo pup in front of him to show him what she would do to him if he ever cheated on her. Yeah.
Oh, I can't. I just...
And that was before knocking him out with a frying pan.
Who does she think she is? Fucking Rapunzel?
Come on, right? That's exactly what I thought. Rapunzel having frying pans? They make great weapons. So in 1988, they had a daughter, which made Sanders put a deposit down on a house. Then Catherine paid off the rest when she got her workers' comp through from when she hurt her back. She then took it upon herself to decorate their house in what I would describe as a modern Buffalo Bill shabby chic style.
A la Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. Now, oh, I know Amy and Bianca love HDTV and home deco house.
So oh, yeah. Love it too. Fuck off. You love it too.
Yeah, I do.
You actually love it too.
So I'm going to describe the types of things that were decorated.
Oh, good. Go.
Where am I? So she decorated with animal skins, skulls, horns, rusty traps, leather jackets, old boots, machetes, rakes, and pitchforks.
Oh, darling, no. No, we want to go for modern farmhouse. Yeah, not scary killer, like serial killer. We don't want to go for that. Modern farmhouse, yeah. That's trending right now.
Yeah, so no, it's modern Buffalo Bill shabby chic. Yeah. Buffalo Bill, you can take in many ways. You can go the fictional book character, like, you know, the Old West character, or you could go Silence of the Lambs.
Pretty sure she had a pit in her yard somewhere where there was somebody just sitting there, and if they didn't put the lotion on the skin, and they'd get the hose in. So
yeah, 100%. So things started to go downhill in this relationship when, during an argument, Saunders was hit in the face with an iron before being stabbed with a pair of scissors. He moves out of the house for a bit, but when he returns, he finds his clothes have been shredded.
Why so, are you coming back?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, why? My God. I can't even get one man, and she's just like some psycho, and she's got them, just keeps coming back. Why?
They keep coming back. I don't understand. Magic vagina, maybe.
Oh,
who knows?
Definitely really more magic than mine.
So he takes some long service leave and goes into hiding. Now, Catherine tries to find him, but ain't no one given up his location to that crazy bitch. No one. They're like, nope, don't know it. Turns a few months later to see his daughter and finds out that Catherine has gone and taken out an AVO against him.
She fucking has.
She has. She took the AVO out on him because he is a dangerous man to her. So, in 1990... And again, I don't know how she keeps getting them, but she gets pregnant by another man.
For fuck's sake.
I know it. What the fuck?
Magic vagina.
Yeah.
So she gets pregnant by a former co-worker, John Chillingworth, and gives birth the next year, so 1991. Now, there wasn't much on this relationship that I found, except that it lasted for 3 years. Before she left him for a man she was having an affair with.
Bitch fox, mate. Yeah. Bitch fox.
So she kills a puppy and says, if you cheat on me, this is what I'm going to do to you. Yet she'll go off and cheat on her partner? Nah. Fuck you, bitch.
So we've got David, John and John.
Yeah, okay, so the next guy is John Price.
Yep, okay.
So, hang on, let me have another drink. It still smells like it's been singed, like hair, but it tastes all right. So, John Price was born in April of 1955, making him pretty much the same age as Catherine. He was very much liked in the community. Everyone who knew him loved him.
Maybe that was this guy, actually.
Yeah, maybe that was this guy.
No.
His marriage ended in 1988, and he had 3 kids. One that lived with his ex-wife and 2 that lived with him. Now, he was aware of Catherine's violent reputation when she moved into his house in 95. But his kids seemed to like her. And he was making good money working at the mines. So apart from the violent arguments every now and then, life was pretty good. But in 1998... the couple had a fight over Price's refusal to marry. To get him back for this, she videotaped items he had allegedly stolen from work and sent the tape to his boss. Although the items were out of date, like medical kits that he had scavenged from the company's bin and other shit, he was fired because, well... hey, he was stealing shit. So he lost his job that he had for 17 years.
Jesus.
Yeah. That
talk
same
about
day,
fucking cut your nose off to spite your face. He's earning money to support the family, and she's going and undercutting him like that. Like, what the fuck are you doing?
This woman's not sane. So the same day, he kicked her out of the house and she returned to her own place, while news of what she had done had actually spread through the town. A couple of months later, Dickhead Price, I'm going to call you a dickhead just because you took her back. You restarted the relationship. Like, why? So he now refused to allow her to move in with him, and with good reason. They started fighting more frequently, and most of his friends would no longer have anything to do with him because they didn't like her. So as long as you're with her, we're not having anything to do with you. In February 2000, after the assaults on Price, it ended with Catherine stabbing him in the chest. She actually stabbed him in the chest. Like, fucking, fuck you, cunt. I'm going to stab you. He was fed up.
He dropped the C word.
Look, we've all been there. We've all been there.
He dropped the C word.
I'm sorry, listeners. Oh, my God. I apologize.
Oh, leave when I'm ready, okay?
Yeah. So he was finally fed up. He kicked her out of his house, and on the 29th, he stopped off at the Scorn Magistrate Court on his way to work and took out a restraining order against her in an attempt to keep her away from himself and his children. That afternoon, Price had actually told his co-workers, if I don't come to work the next day, it will be because Catherine has murdered him. Despite their pleas that Price not return home, he stated that he was afraid that if he didn't, Catherine would kill his children. So Price arrived home to find that Catherine, although not there herself, had sent her children away for a sleepover at a friend's house. He then spent the evening with his neighbours before returning home and going to bed at 11 p.m. Earlier that day, Catherine had bought new black lingerie and had videotaped all the children while making comments, which have since been interpreted as like a crude will.
So she was like planning a murder-suicide.
Yeah.
So, hold on, I'm so confused. She was wearing black lingerie and filming her children?
Well, no, she bought black lingerie and filmed the children. She wasn't wearing the lingerie at the time.
Okay.
So it's almost like she's gearing up for something. Yeah. Like, she's bought black lingerie, she's videotaping her children, she's making comments, which seems like it's a will. Like, what is she going to do?
So later that night, she showed up at Price's house while he was sleeping. She actually sat there and watched television for a little while before having a shower. So she then wakes Price up and they have sex, after which he falls back asleep. So the next day, the neighbors become concerned when they see that Price's car is still in the driveway at 6 a.m. And when he does not arrive at work, his employer becomes concerned and sends a co-worker to see what's wrong. Both the co-worker and neighbor try knocking on Price's bedroom window to wake him up, but then they call the police after noticing blood on the front door. The police arrive around 8 a.m., break down the door, and that's when the police find Price's body. They also find that Catherine was comatose from taking a shit ton of pills. Probably
that's a technical measurement, people. Yeah.
In the hopes of killing herself. So what had happened was she had stabbed him with the butcher's knife while he was sleeping. So according to the blood evidence, he'd actually woken up, as you would, and tried to turn on.
Some do, some don't, mate. Yeah, so it's a mixed bag.
So, yeah, according to the blood evidence, he woke up and he tried to turn on the light before attempting to escape while Catherine chased him through the house, stabbing him some more. It also showed that he managed to open the front door and get outside, but he either stumbled back in or she dragged him back into the hallway, where he finally died after bleeding out. Later on, Price's autopsy revealed that he'd been stabbed at least 37 times in both the front and the back of his body.
Poor bastard, never had a chance, really.
Yep, with many of the wounds extending into vital organs. So several hours after Price had died, that's when Catherine had skinned him and hung his skin from meat hooks on the door frame of the lounge room.
She's some fucking predator.
Yeah. She then decapitated him and cooked parts of his body, serving up the meat with baked potato, pumpkin, beetroot, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and a gravy in two settings at the dinner table, along with notes beside each plate, each having names of Price's children on it.
Fuck me.
As in, yeah. His children, have some dinner, and here's a note for you. A third meal was thrown on the back lawn for unknown reason, and it's speculated that Knight had actually tried to eat it but couldn't get through it. So, yeah, that's been put forward in support of her claim that she has no memory of the crime. Price's head was actually found in a pot of vegetables.
Yeah.
Like a stew. The pot was still warm, estimated to be between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius, which is 104 to 122 Fahrenheit for our American listeners, indicating that the cooking had taken place in the early morning.
Oh, yeah, she's just bubbling away. She's just a nice simmer.
Just making it nice and tender, yeah. So later,
meat just literally falls off the bone.
So sometime later after that, Knight had actually arranged the body, skinless body, with the left arm draped over an empty 1.25 litre soft drink with the legs crossed.
Oh, yeah. My God.
So here's your drink, love. Fuck? Just put that around your arm and just cross your legs and relax. Relax on that couch. Yeah, just relax, Bianca, with your headless self.
Bianca, I feel like that term, what in the actual fuck, is not used enough in this podcast.
I've got like full visuals and I'm like, not what the actual fuck.
Yeah. So they claim that the act of this kind of defamation demonstrates Knight's contempt for Price.
Oh, just her fucking crazy.
Yeah, she's fucking crazy. I mean, she cut off parts of his body to cook and gave it to, for his children. I mean, come on. So her initial plea was to plead for guilty of manslaughter.
Oh, fuck off.
But that was rejected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck off.
Right off.
Yeah. So
when you get there, fuck off some more. Yeah.
This is for manslaughter. Fuck off.
Can I point out the way she skinned him was so perfect that after the autopsy, they could just lay the skin over and just sew up perfectly.
Oh, whoop.
Yeah. No. Professionally skinned. Because remember, she worked at an abattoir.
You know, that's really right.
Job. Promoted because she was so good at it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really fucking sad, right? Is that if she hadn't been abused, during her childhood, and if she had been raised up right, with the skills that she naturally had, like for skinning and all that sort of stuff, could you imagine the kind of surgeon that she could have been? She could have been saving lives, not fucking ending them.
She was arranged on the 2nd of March 2001.
Arrange.
Yeah. Shut up. I'm just like a bottle and a couple down because I was free drinking. So I'm doing well on the 2nd of March 2001 on the charge of murder of Price, to which she entered a plea of not guilty. Yeah.
Yep. I love it when these fuckwits try and maintain that they're innocent. Well, everything points to the fact that you did it. We have all the evidence, you dumb fuck.
So her trial was initially fixed on for the 23rd of July 2001, but was adjourned due to her counsel's illness and was refixed for the 15th of October 2001. When the trial commenced, Justice Barry, I love his name, Barry O'Keefe.
Yeah.
So he offered the 60 jury prospects the opportunity of being excused due to the nature of the photographic evidence, which 5 accepted. When the
the other 55 were like, oh, it's going to be gruesome, I'm in.
Yeah. When the witness list was read out to the prospects, several more also dropped out, after which the jury was impaneled. Catherine's attorney then spoke to the judge, who adjourned to the following day. The next morning, she changed her plea to guilty and the jury was dismissed. It was made public that Justice O'Keefe had actually advised of the plea change the day before. He adjourned the trial and then ordered a psychiatric assessment overnight to determine if she understood the consequences of pleading guilty. But her legal team had planned on to defend Knight by claiming amnesia.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I have amnesia. I don't remember. Well, she did say she didn't remember doing it. So, yeah. So amnesia and disassociation, a claim supported by most like psychiatrics, although they did consider her sane. 2 psychiatric.
Psychiatrists.
Psychiatrics. I don't know. I'm actually so freaking blurry right now. I don't even know why I'm looking at my screen. And I'm wearing my glasses. Hi. I am that blind.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. They concluded that she suffered from borderline personality disorder. Yeah, fucking think. So no reason has ever been given for her guilty plea. And despite giving it, she still refuses to accept a responsibility for her actions. At the sentence hearing, her lawyers requested that she be excused to avoid hearing some of the facts. yeah, just because, you know, it could damage her.
Oh, what? Dear. The things you did might damage you, you poor darling.
That was actually refused. So when Timothy Lyons took the stand and described the skinning and the decapitation, Knight became hysterical and had to be sedated.
Oh, fucking, yeah, okay.
On the 8th of November, Justice O'Keefe pointed out the nature of the crime and her lack of remorse required a severe penalty. So he sentenced her to life imprisonment and ordered that her papers be marked never to be released.
Jesus. You know that there's not a lot of people that have that marked.
Definitely. The first time that this has actually been imposed on a woman in Australian history.
Jeez. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he saw this as such a heinous crime and so horrific. Dun, dun. You're fucking going in there and you ain't fucking coming out.
This was a crime that was especially heinous. Dun.
So in June 2006, she actually appealed the life sentence, claiming that the penalty of life in prison without the possibility of parole was too severe for the killing. So you've got 3 different justices that have all turned around and dismissed the appeal in the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeals in September, which one of them has written, this was an appalling crime, almost beyond contemplation of, I can't even see that,
In civilized society.
Civilized society. Yes, I can see. Sorry, I've moved my screen. It's less blurry. So she's still alive now. She's still alive. She's aged 65 and is living what I'm going to assume is a cushy life in prison in New South Wales.
It's literally fucking Orange Is the New Black.
Because our jails seem to have everything for the prisoners. They live somewhat cushy lives in there.
Right.
So that's the end of my story. Thank you.
Wow.
Come to my TED.
Yeah. You got there, mate. Good job.
I know. I felt like I was talking forever and, you know.
You
I
really were. You really, really were, mate.
You weren't I'm really because Captain Interrupty here, which was me this week, was talking for many, many parts. So, yeah. Anyway, let's move on to shout out. So, Bianca, you shout out.
I do have a shout out. I actually want to say a massive thank you to my sister for picking my murderer for me. I would also like to say for our listeners who love a bit of Twitch, check her out. Her handle is Danny_Hell. So that's DANNI_HELL. And while you're there, give her a follow. She plays Phasmophobia every Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Australia. And she has sounds that you can play to scare her. Hmm. She also has, you can type in !Darood, and it will start playing Darood Sandstorm. Which is great when she's got the ghost hunting her. It's amazing. Just all of a sudden, we're having a rave. It's awesome. So look, I have so much fun interacting on her streams. If you do pop in and happen to see, has anybody seen Tron? That's me. So say hi.
Do you see Tails? You might see him in the closet again.
Thank you. Everybody goes, I don't know if Tron was okay. And I'm like, it's the fucking Simpsons. How do you not
you
get it from
Tails,
that
you're in the linen closet. Like, how is this not something transposing to another generation? I don't get it.
I know. I've even got it on my Twitch profile. Like, it's, has anybody seen Tron? And then, like, my about me. If you see Tails, you're in the linen closet.
So good.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, I'll have a link to Danny's Twitch on our blog too. So, yeah. Thanks, Danny.
I actually don't know what Twitch is. So I'm just going to plug it because I don't really know what it is. But Danny's on it. So, yay, Danny. That's
it's
all I've
it's
about
just
that.
Live streaming games.
Yeah. just a quick one to our listeners. We are now fully functioning on Instagram. So can you please follow/like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr? Of course, you can always send us an email at FridayNightWineFight@gmail.com or visit our blog at FridayNightWineFight@blogspot.com.
Yes.
I've had so much fun researching this topic as I did with all of the other topics in the past few weeks. I am a massive true crime buff. I've listened to all the podcasts and I fucking love it. Shout out to Wine and Crime, who were the inspo for this fucking podcast.
Yes.
Thanks, bitches. We love
thank you. Thank
you. Oh, my God. Yes, queens. Yes, queens.
Yeah.
However, we would love some topic suggestions from our listeners. If you have a topic which you would like us to discuss, email us at friday.winefight@gmail.com. To everyone who has listened to this, we would like to thank each and every one of you for your time in listening to our utter fucking rubbish. We hope that you have found it entertaining and not using any of the facts discussed in this recording to make important decisions in your lives. Unless that's in relation to getting rid of your crazy ass ex, getting a murder floof, and possibly buying yourself a protection chainsaw. Yeah. And if you're going to do any of those things, then we thoroughly support you.
Yeah.
Peace out, guys. Bye.